Hello, and thank you for tuning in to 97.7 K-Wink. We are Mass Liberation Radio. My name is Lily.
I'm Kaylee.
We are so happy to have you listening on this freezing day.
K-Wink is brought to you by over 50 DJs. Shout out to all the radio stations. Shout out Move Soothers. Shout out Bijou and Courtney.
Our girls. We love you, girls. Mm-hmm.
There's a new show, Bluebird Radio, is hosting folks who are in the senior center, so check that one out.
Yes, shout out the Notables. And shout out to you for supporting community radio. Everyone should continue to support K-Wink. The third year anniversary is coming on up on October 31st. But we are here today with a special guest, as always. Jody, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. What do you do?
I do a lot of different things on different days, but at the moment I work in the Center Every Student, Every Story at the University of Nevada, Reno. I teach a few classes through different departments. Yeah, I'm going to leave it there. I'm a scholar. I'm a hip-hop scholar.
I love it. So I love that. I was hoping you would say that. What do you think right now is the most important thing that we can get from all of these? There have been a lot of beefs, so I'm not going to, especially as things get more political, I'm not going to zero in on any yet. But what do you think we can get from these hip-hop slash political beefs that we're seeing right now?
I think if you go back to the roots, which I think that's where I got to go to answer, where hip-hop came from is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
People using their voice in spaces that they felt powerless politically and using their voice to say, you know what, if we don't get to play and we don't get to sit at your table, we're going to make our own table. We're going to create our own music with our own elements, and then you can respond to it. People didn't think it would last, but here we are today, all these years later, and those messages are global. The way that people use their voice when there's supposed to be quiet, in quotation marks, that's our power today, is we can't be quiet. We can't silence ourselves, even when people say we should be silenced.
Yep, we're not going anywhere, everyone. I'm sure I like to picture like one angry listener. like a lot of other listeners that maybe agree, but then maybe there's like one person knitting a Betsy Ross flag that just doesn't like us.
Yeah, I want to get your take on female MCs and the impact of women entering the hip-hop game. Of course, there has been women in the hip-hop game, but not at this scale. So do you want to speak on that?
Hold on. Yes or have at this scale? Since 93, there have been a ton, I think. But are you talking about, like, No Name? Is that what we're talking about?
No, like, just, like, a bunch of
them. Just all of them, yeah.
Like Megan Thee Stallion. Megan Thee Stallion, Cardi B, No Name, like, those are all good. Like, Rico Nasty, like, all the women that are in hip-hop. I'm, of course, Lil Kim's the blueprint, but
Lauryn Hill's a blueprint.
Yeah. A lot for, like, the, like, sexual empowerment, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, please tell us about the chronology of female in hip-hop. Go.
Yeah, and it's the same everywhere that women have been there, especially black women, not getting due, not getting recognition, being erased. When I think of hip-hop, the beginning, I go to Gil Scott-Heron, I go to The Last Poets, I go to people who were spoken word before, and so you've got to add in Sonia Sanchez, June Jordan.
Audre Lorde.
Poets and writers,
right.
and Anna Julia Cooper,
mm-hmm.
and but though this is probably the biggest is erasure,
mm-hmm.
you know, those messages Anna Julia Cooper wrote at the turn of the century, 1900s, when W.B. Du Bois, Carter G. Woodson, all these people are getting shine, but no one remembers her work,
mm-hmm.
and so of course at the beginning of hip hop, women were there. I actually have. If you know Davey D, he's someone I tend to follow his work from the Bay. But he once said at a conference, and he denied it in an interview after.
Mm.
But he said hip-hop started by sisters doing double dutch.
Mm-hmm.
That the rhymes people were doing double dutch, that was the original hip-hop. And then all the dudes came along, and they're like, whoa, that's cool. I want to steal some of their rhymes. And so from the beginning, women are there. It, That's very clear. Mm-hmm. Women are everywhere. Black Panther Party. I've invited a couple Panthers here, and the women in the party were way more exciting, way more. They knew a lot more about what was going on. It's just kind of our nature to give men the shine. Mm-hmm. And then we got to go to 1993. For sure, women were there at the beginning. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Superfly. Remember Missy Elliott? Remember old school Missy Elliott? Remember that video? Oh, that was a good video. Just a moment of silence for the Super Duper Fly video.
I mean, y'all coming in a little bit later. That's like
that's a little later. That's
for
later.
My mind, but it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. We can go there.
That was the time when music videos existed, and there were. I feel like I was watching them. We were earlier talking about a recent video that I hadn't seen. I feel like I never watch music videos anymore. Maybe I should. But that seems to be like a. I think I'm processing so much new music now because it's so much more accessible that I'm not stopping to watch videos anymore.
I like videos because I think I'm just like a visual person. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
I like videos. I just don't think about it. Mm-hmm. I think I just most of the music that I listen to is in the car.
Totally. Yeah.
So yeah, I do want to talk about. We talked about it on the show last time, but I feel like maybe you'd have a different perspective about the No Name and J. Cole. They had a little beef, and I felt like the way that No Name dealt with it was really beautiful. Again, just coming with like way more knowledge and barely shedding light on, you know, that on J. Cole's misstep, but really bringing the focus back to missing and murdered Black and Indigenous women. And I thought that was a really nice way to deal with that.
What did J. Cole do?
He said something about her. He said something about her. She didn't like it. Again, I didn't really go deeply into what it was. He dissed her on a track, and she came back with another track that was like this, saying basically, of all the things that are going on right now, you're going to talk about me. You know, of all the things going on in the community, why would we take any time to have a personal beef?
So my take on that, first of all, I love No Name. And we had an artist in residency here that was in the same loft as No Name. I guess in Chicago they have these lofts where artists stay and do their work and then they can be in community and be more creative. Mm-hmm. I would have J. Cole. He tends to be stepping in beefs that I don't know. Like, he's in Africa getting shot. The mm-hmm. whole YBN Cordae, 1985. Like, what is it that people like to come for J. Cole? But I don't know if I can... Without more, I would just probably tend to go for No Name in how you described it.
Right. I kind of didn't need to hear what he said after I heard her song. Does that make sense? I was like, well, I don't really care what he said because I feel like she won.
I'm going to listen to the song because I think that's where you get the answers.
Yeah.
But sometimes these backstories to music, they're more interesting than the music itself. Mm-hmm. What has J. Cole done recently?
Good question.
I don't hate him. I'm not that one.
I know. That's true.
But where is he at?
Because he could be. Because he has a lot of great things to say, and I feel like we need all of those voices. Did you do that? Kaylee, is the...
I got the line. This is what he says in his song. I don't know what song it is, but he, like, I think it... Oh, newly released song, Snow on the Bluff. He says, my IQ is average. There's a young lady out there. She's way smarter than me. I scrolled through her timeline in these wild times, and I started to read. She mad at these crackers. She mad at these capitalists. Mad at these murder police. She mad at my N-word. She mad at our ignorance. She wear her heart on her sleeve. She mad at the celebrities. Low-key, I be thinking she's talking about me. Now, I ain't no dummy to think I'm above criticism, so when I see something that's valid, I listen. Zish, something about the queen tone that's bothering me.
Ooh.
So it's going to be the queen tone,
it's
right?
It's going to be the queen tone. Ooh. Yeah. I didn't like that.
Kind of gave the cringe, like, what the? What did he just do with that?
Yeah. Well, and you were just talking about that, women, you know, a lot of the time, we let you guys have the shine. We know... that we know more sometimes, and we just let you because it's not worth you know.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, he confirmed that that line was about No Name.
Okay.
So I think I have to go back to what we had a great convo before the show, but part of that for me is my feminist friends put me on blast. So I teach in a women's studies department, gender at the beginning of the department, gender, race, and identity, and I'm in these spaces, but my black feminist friends be putting me on blast, and I have to listen. You know what I'm saying? Like so. But here's the thing that also was a second to that whole queen vibe that he's talked about is when you try to be too, as a man, if I'm like, oh, women to the front, like it's almost fake too. Like mm-hmm. you need someone to move you to the front when, of course, it's a fine line. Of course, women's voices and black women's voices are erased. But it's like, oh, you're a kindergartner. And you need some basic instruction. So I feel like in his tone was some of that as well. Like, well, of course, I'm going to be paying attention to things that need to be said, and you know, if they're about me. But that's a fine line that, yo, my black feminist friends have me on blast. And I'm just going to be quiet when in certain spaces, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. And all of us, Leslie posted yesterday something just, it's okay to admit when you're wrong because that's part of learning. And if anyone is at a point in their study that they feel like they've learned everything, you haven't, you know, and that's all of us. We all have books to read. We all have people to listen to. We all need to be on a continuous quest for knowledge, I think, or we can never get better at anything, right?
Yeah, I totally agree, Lily. I always say I feel like you can learn something different from every single person because everyone just doesn't know everything. And I think everyone can grow. And, you know, we talk about a lot on the show, like cancel culture and how, like, you know, you can't necessarily cancel everyone all the time. There are, like, moments for that. But, you know, some people are still learning and trying to grow from that. And we need to start educating and teaching people.
Yeah, I think people, especially that don't work with kids that much, have a really hard time. And I think you and I have both worked with young children, and you do learn something from kids every day. And so if you can learn something from a 2-year-old, you can learn something from your coworker, from whomever at any time.
On this one, I don't know. There are certain things you can't learn from a book. And sitting and listening to my students is probably the best way that I learn exactly. But on this one, there are experiences that women have that I still need to go and understand. Mm-hmm. Not that I'll ever understand, but at least know they exist. And so many of my women students, just talking about walking across campus,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's happening here that I never had that experience. Certain individuals, not to name names, that treat women differently than they treat men in a really creepy, cringy way. And you're like, well, I didn't know that. And so there are certain things that I just have to listen more. That I don't think a book will tell me. I read a lot of books. I love books.
But that's true that with, you know, female interactions, I have a friend who's a DJ in town, a female friend, and we have talked about some of our male colleagues in the music industry and how they're super cringy to us, and they've all done things that we, you know, almost dang near every man I've worked with has done something out of pocket, you know, and we've had a lot of those similar instances happen, but feel as if, you know, we can't say anything about it or we won't get any work. As it is, we get less work. But saying, you know, calling out our co-workers or our colleagues that, you know, may say something or do an inappropriate gesture or touch you inappropriately at once, you know, you're loose at a show or something like that, like, you know, other men don't know that this is going on. They would, you know, like, well, why didn't you say something? Well, because we can't say anything, you know. So, yeah, that stuff can't be learned in a book for sure. But it's definitely prevalent, I think, in every industry.
I wonder how that goes back to the whole Jay-Z No Name. Sorry, mm-hmm. J. Cole No Name. And I think even the fact that the first as soon as I asked it, I thought, so what did J. Cole say, right? But
mm-hmm.
Maybe No Name's response is way more important to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
But how does everything you said play back to what you first brought up? Because, yeah, No Name, first of all, No Name is an artist in a, this is my generational bias, but in a hip-hop era that there isn't as much artistry. Mm-hmm. So I love her music for the musicality, for the artistry. And that's probably why I responded first there. And J. Cole's kind of this, he can think, but they're not on the same level. You know
right,
what I'm saying?
Right. I agree. Her artistry far, far expands over, you know, what he's done. But I am a J. Cole fan too. You know, obviously I listened to him first, you know, but definitely a huge J. Cole fan. But his stuff can't touch No Name stuff. You know, you would never, it's not even the same mood.
Mm-hmm. It's a vibe. You know, she's from Chicago. That's what we got.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Black feminism with you, because I was recently on a panel where we talked about whether or not Black men can be feminists also. And I just kind of wanted to ask someone like yourself about what your take is on that. Like, yes, no, why?
I'm going to get specific on this one because I feel like everything we said mm-hmm. to this point, yes. But we had Aisha Durham, who's part of the Hip Hop Crunk Feminist Collective, come. And my favorite, it's the Pleasure Ninjas. Mm-hmm. They theorize Black women's pleasure. And it's Joan Morgan and a few other scholars that are they're heavy hitters. But I went to Stanford last year and saw them. And so mad respect for the way they portray their feminism, but and being in their space, I totally vibe with them. But when Aisha Durham came last year, then she had me on blast like every 2 seconds. Like, and she actually, no, in all honesty, she invited me to write with her.
Wow.
For a collect. So it was, she had me on blast, but she was inviting me in. And it was just like she was trying to tell me there are boundaries to where you can come into this conversation. And I think that as someone who, if I claim being a feminist, which I often do, I mean, I don't know if I can do that, but I do. And I think I just have to know where my limits are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where at some point I'm going to shut the hell up and let this experience be told. In a recent conversation, we had the State of Blackness on campus. And we had, because a lot of times left out of Black feminism or discussions about gender is because we're in the binary, right? So mm-hmm. there's non-binary folk that are being left out. And I think that we brought Evolve Benton from UCSF. Well, they came virtually. And it was enlightening, just like the way that, okay, this may be a line I might not cross. But there are people who can do it, and if you invite people to the discussion, then maybe my contribution is making sure that people are at the table who can cover all parts of the discussion. So we had Evolve, and we had an incredible discussion, but Aisha Durham there was a point where I was like, Aisha Durham is talking to our Black non-binary students, our Black feminist students, and I probably got to, like, step away, because it literally, at the breakfast table, I'm like, you know, I'm so excited to talk to Aisha Durham because she's a hip-hop scholar. But you know what? The way they're talking, they as in this group of students, I probably got to, like, let them have the space because I'm always trying to be in there with my ear. And so I don't know. It's allowing things. Look, if I know I'm in the middle of a conversation I shouldn't be, then maybe I got to step away.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like that is feminism, right? I think that, you know, that doesn't mean you have to know what the experience is. It means that you have to give precedent to the experience, to the people who have had the experience, and support that conversation.
Yeah, I think that is very feminist, because it's you're letting the people who are directly impacted at the center of the conversation, mm-hmm. which we talk about a lot, and I think that's super important. So, yeah, props to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I still got chewed, but and I didn't work it all out. I didn't work it all out, but I did. I mean, I did get to learn a lot from that interaction and the thing. First of all, Aisha Durham scholarship. I did get to kick it with the Pleasure Ninjas for a little bit, so that to me was incredibly healing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got power. They got power in the things they say, and so. When you're measuring feminism, what is feminism? Is it just that I'm pro-women? Am I a womanist? Is it that you understand, so maybe this is where my line would be, you understand the things that make women, that are important to women. And I think that's what I learned from the Pleasure Ninjas.
Mm-hmm.
And value them, because their whole idea is that a lot of the work about that claims to be feminist is about Black women's trauma, and that their claim is, when we come together as Black women, we make ourselves enjoy the moment and find pleasure in the moment. But they open it up to talk about sex, and it could have gone any way on the planet. And instead of talking about sex, which they did include in their responses, they talked about the things that gave them pleasure,
mm-hmm.
like cooking for someone they were attracted to, like one of their best friends having a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our discussion, going back to hip hop too, so because we talked about women in hip hop, there most definitely is misogyny. There's all kinds of exploitation, but there's other sides. So instead of just focusing on the negative, which we know exists, it's like, let's go to what are Black women experiencing?
Mm-hmm.
How can I learn from this, right? Like, how can I learn from someone who's at the top of the game? If we're talking about voting, Black women, the vote is, they've bend things and make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all we're going to do is focus on that and not the real of what it's like to be a Black woman. Or even ask a Black woman, what's going on? Why are you making these decisions? I was raised by my single Black father, but my grandmother, his mother, is the person who taught me everything I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I have mad respect. And the thing that is so, maybe is opposite of most of what I said right now, is that there is so much hate for Black women. Like, Black women, you'll just be sitting at a table and someone randomly, without prompting, mm-hmm. will say something bad about Black women.
You can just, we just, Black women, it's like a meme. Like, Black women exist. And it's just like the world exploding. Like, we don't, what did we do then? What now?
So why?
I want to talk about that. Because I find sometimes when I get into, when I call out certain situations, oftentimes it's usually in a circle where maybe the dominating demographic is white men, but they will send in a Black man to talk to me. And I find that happens a lot. So as a Black man, how would you address, have you been sent into battle against a Black woman, firstly? And secondly, like, why is that not the thing to do?
I think I'm going to deviate. I'm gonna deflect, but I'm answering, right?
Okay.
So, but I'm going to answer. Okay. It's just the first one, though. Because I think that's part, and I'm going to use white supremacy as the measure here. But so I got to sit down with an Olympian who told about the Tommy Smith-John Carlos incident,
mm-hmm.
and how they sent Jesse Owens after. They mm-hmm. sent Jesse Owens to tell Tommy Smith and John Carlos that they were off the team. And so nobody else could have the guts to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they sent another Black man to tell a Black man. I think that's there in the way people work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe showing an experience is the fact that you would send a Black man who has a different relationship to, so gender, people aren't thinking about intersectionality.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want, before I abuse the term, it comes from Kimberly Crenshaw.
Yes.
It comes from a Black woman.
Right.
Talking about the differences participating in society there are in being a Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that, and then someone making a decision, it happens so often.
Mm-hmm.
People in power will miss, they won't understand intersectionality, and they won't understand the dynamic of a Black man going to talk to a Black woman. And that one, I can't.
It's a big one.
But it's not going to happen for me, because you can see how much gender in Black community plays a role in how we interact.
Mm-hmm.
And how, I don't think we'll resolve that today. This may be...
Wait, we're not going to solve racism again this week?
Not racism.
God.
I'm talking within
and
community.
And intersectionality.
I'm talking about Black men and Black women.
Yes. No, we're not solving that today. Maybe next week, though.
But it's deep.
It is. It is. And it's... But it is a very... it's still the patriarchy. Like, that's still a patriarchal response to, it's as if Black women can't can't be correct until a black man has agreed. And if they're wrong, the black man is the one who's sent in to chastise or, you know, set them straight, collect them.
It's like almost like a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's like,
yeah, you can see it. Like I can visually picture it happening. You know, like, oh, they're going to say, okay.
Yeah, if the black man agrees with you, you're right. Mm-hmm. If he's not, if he doesn't, then you're wrong.
Right. If he stands up for what you said, then the white men are checked.
They're like, okay.
And women are checked. But if he says that you're wrong, then you're the crazy black woman. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that's going to be, you know?
Yeah.
I think what I'm trying to say is that's such a big mistake because the dynamics between black men and black women are so, there's such a divide in us coming together,
mm-hmm.
that the person who did it didn't understand that, and they triple making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe what I see more often, although, so both, is white women doing the work for black women.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not trying to take it away from black men. But if someone does it, they don't understand how much we have to heal ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And within community, I think we can talk about that, right? So
yeah.
Black people understand, okay, well, and this brother ain't this, I think I'm going to get bleeped, but
that's fine.
She hasn't gotten into it, right?
Right.
Like I talked to so many age doesn't matter where black women she hasn't gotten into it. And that's the way we start right off. So the reason why Joan Morgan is the guru on this one is because she wrote Chicken Heads.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicken Heads is kind of, it says to me, this is a definition of black feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And she tweaks it a little bit because she says she likes chivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, she does like to be treated like a queen. And she does like to, you know, have her man do certain things. But that just tells you when you read Chicken Heads how far we're apart in how we treat each other. How at the same time in the flip, I don't know if you watched Nikki Giovanni,
mm-hmm.
and the interview that she has.
Yes, with
James
Baldwin. Yeah, I actually just revisited that, and I'm using a sample from that in a recording I'm doing this week.
You got to.
Because
Nikki Giovanni lays him out.
She does.
And she does
She's
it so
like,
well.
No, no.
Bring this to the table.
Yes.
I don't care. Just come home. And the thing,
yes.
though, but the thing for me on that one is black love is black wealth. So that,
mm-hmm.
so along the lines of all of this, when we can find a way to love, then I think that's what other people are going to measure by money and all. They're going to measure success, but our love is our wealth.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I love that. I want to call the title of this show today, Black Love is Black Wealth.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It is. I like that. I think that's the way that I'm viewing the recent nonprofit Black Wall Street that's coming up here, is that they're talking about Black Wall Street not in a capitalist sense, I don't think. And it seems more like the wealth of the love that we have for the community and sharing things with each other and building everyone up and having more mutual aid. So I like the idea of using Black Wall Street, of reclaiming that name in a non-capitalist sense of the word.
Like sharing knowledge and education because they have
the bookstore.
Yep.
I most definitely agree, and a lot. I have this glory days of Detroit and Cleveland, which I keep saying, but that's where I learned blackness. And I use this. I actually say this quite a bit lately because we can measure wealth in money. But I remember Mr. James. I didn't have money per se to learn how to play the trumpet, but Mr. James was going to teach me the trumpet. And the way that we do things when we're in community, we need to bring back in value. And it's not always an exchange in money.
Mm-hmm.
And so most definitely, I'm wondering what Black Wall Street looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a lot of hookups? Is it a lot of, like, if we, and probably most critical to that is people, even especially a lot of black people say, well, black people won't help each other. Or like compare ourselves to other races and then say, well, this group does this and they stack chips and they come together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just different how we do it.
I've seen that comparison with Asian folks a lot. I see that all the time. Constantly want to talk about how, you know, we should have our own da-da-da-da-da. But I think that we do. Black people have a wealth in, you know, the culture point for sure, we have the corner on that, you know, when we talk about music and dance and all sorts of different cultural arts, writing, that is also worthy of something. You know, it doesn't have to be a nail salon for it to be worth something to the community.
At some point, I study Black history, like a lot, and I look, and because our education system gives us, you know, Malcolm and Martin, and that's the only two Black people we can ever look
at, right?
That's it. But around Martin is easily 100, 150, 200 people that made the March on Washington possible, mm-hmm. who will never – and the more I look into Black history, the more I see there's no way I'm going to understand this because there's so many people left out. It's actually a positive thing for me when I start to do it and just see how many people come together to make things happen. But the way we're taught, you don't get to see that. There's a lot of people. When we're doing our thing, it's going to involve a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's definitely like a tool of white supremacy for sure. Just trying to say, oh, there are these two people and that was it. And they're gone now. So you figure it out.
Yeah, I'm glad that you bring that up because I feel like Fannie Lou Hamer is mm-hmm. like a Black woman that's like often like left out of the conversation. But she was like a huge figure in the civil rights movement. And yeah, like you said, it's just Martin and Malcolm.
Well, with the whole Rosa Parks story, too, like that she was just looked better on paper, you know, so they used her. Her story instead. I think that, yeah, it is interesting the way that history plays out and all in the huge gaps that everyone with a general education, K through 12 education has, you know, whatever you graduated with in the way of Black history, K through 12, if you haven't gone back through, it's you need to.
And maybe that's for this moment is where we move forward, realizing that if we're going to – anything's going to pop off in Reno positive, we got to come together. And there are so many of us here
mm-hmm.
that even here we get isolated like we're the only people here when we're definitely present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see a Black person every day.
Do you speak? Because
every day
don't speak
we do. I do. I actually – I have a Black neighbor. I'm moving – and I found out yesterday that I have a Black neighbor, and she probably thinks I am so nuts because I jumped out of my chair and ran next door. Hi, I'm your new neighbor. She's like, okay, I'm going to work. I'm like, okay.
I very much believe it, but then I live here too. You know what I'm
you know?
Saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we've never met. But that is a thing I've noticed. It depends, you know. you have to reach beyond your own circles all the time because it seems like every group gets their own three Black people and they must never meet. like we were talking about a friend that everyone mentions to me that you both know, and it got to the point where
shout out to Cynthia.
Yeah, okay. Cynthia, wonderful to meet you. But it's so funny because you know the first thing I said to them was, I've heard so much about you. And he's like, me too. Like, finally, it happened. Good. Connection made. So everyone, don't worry. Cynthia and I have met now. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, Reno, I have that in a sense, even though I am white, that perspective too, because I'm from Las Vegas and it's such a big city that like when I came here, it was so shocking because it's just very white and there's like little diversity here. And it's just like, how do we get those communities together? But yeah, like I wanted to ask you, Jody, like you said, you work at the center. How can you speak on your perspective working at a like PWI, predominantly white institution, and like what like comes with that? Like I know we were talking about earlier the swastikas on campus and the campus police.
I mean, that's still pretty open. So I might ask you to redefine it. But no, I actually end up at the center mostly because it is a place where communities come together. And so working in Reno prior to that, not at TMCC because I was at TMCC before, but in other places where I wasn't in a cultural center or a diverse environment, there was a lot of racism and I felt it. So I think I was drawn to the center for people coming together and working with community. The university, as you know, we go on this station, I have some I have a relationship where I'm always going to be challenging how communities of color, students of color are treated. And definitely, you know, as an ally, queer and trans folk, and I've seen times when it doesn't meet up to the needs of just being the basic needs of a student or someone trying to get their education. I'm always going to be trying to promote ethnic studies and learning about our identities. And sometimes, you know, there's allies there, and other times we hit roadblocks. But PWI in itself says a lot, right? So I'm a product of a lot of PWIs and a lot of religious, private, all the things that kind of protect whiteness. And so I go into the classroom, and academic freedom protects me to have discussions, I think, that need to be had but are hard to have in a lot of different places. And then in a strange twist to that, so we're not going to talk about campus police. That was the broad one that we had. Until you ask me directly what you're saying, because I can't even answer what, like, but.
What could you possibly be talking about?
Yeah, Ken? I don't. You get specific, I'll answer. But this is a university. I remember Dr. Paul Mitchell was getting, I saw his dissertation defense when I was younger, when I first got here. And I was like, this is a black man getting his PhD. And I hadn't seen it before. And I saw people in the room who were also black and educated. And so I've looked for that around the country, and I found it here. I do have 2 degrees from this university. I've been able to work, raise a family in this community. I love this community. So just like most things, it's kind of like pluses, wins and losses, pluses and minuses. And at this point, at this exact moment, I just got to say that there's nothing but love for even UNR, which I battle all the time. It's like, I battle because students have experiences.
I had a conversation with another black professor at UNR. I hope it doesn't put him on blast.
It does. Because it they does. Only, yeah.
I know, we all I was like, because there's so many of you.
Yeah, I'm going to be able to narrow it down. And yeah. You said him, so I can definitely start narrowing
up. So I was going back to this conversation that we had because I wanted to talk to you about this now because you kind of brought it up. Do you feel like the university uses the term intersectionality to decenter black issues and black grievance in favor of the diversity, speaking about everything?
Now I really know who it is. And
no, shout out to...
Yeah, you don't have to say it. I just was texting. Okay, so so I spent a lot of time lately. That person is also very vocal and also
literally
powerful.
Literally,
very powerful.
Yes. Well, I'll go. I have another thing after that about that person because they chimed in on a conversation.
Did you interview him?
That happened earlier. No, we were just talking, and then no.
Okay, well...
We should, though. Yeah. Actually, we should definitely interview him.
Well, we were... That's who sent me the text about Devlin.
Really?
We all text all day.
What? I want to be on the group chat.
We were referring to the conversation earlier. It was like, I'll just say it, because so Lily won't have to get an aside. No, I need to wrap up the other
Ooh! No. That wasn't...
How are we going? Yo!
We're not going to do that.
Party who's on the floor will blast anybody anytime.
Can you be canceled twice? Because I believe I'll be canceled twice. That was not what I wanted. I didn't want to bring up the name of the organization will remain nameless, even though it's not a real organization.
I'm going to be diplomatic. I'm going to answer your question. Here it goes. So I spent a lot of time saying exactly what I've already said.
Yes.
And that is where intersectional came from. There's a book, We Want to Do More Than Just Survive, Bettina Love. I spent a lot of time. She has a quote about intersectionality that it to me is powerful. And it talks about intersectionality being more than just the people in the room, but the power dynamics, and gives that history. So I don't think people who employ intersectionality a lot of times will give credit to black women for why intersectionality exists.
Right.
So, and I'm not really answering, I'm putting two answers together. And this is my diplomacy, right?
Well, because the story is about when the university had a panel on racism through the political science department, and that this was a conversation I had with the professor that we both know, right before that conversation, because I'm not a student of this university, even though everyone wants to assume that I am because I'm, I don't know, maybe a person of color that exists in Reno. No, I didn't go to UNR, so sorry. But that was the kind of the thing that he warned me about before. He was like, don't let that happen, you know? And I'm like, oh, don't worry, I won't. Yeah. And yeah, no, so but seeing if you think that happens.
The second part is, so I'm being diplomatic, right? Just remember, I'm just inserting those quotations. The second part is how many places claim multiculturalism and it weakens and drown out blackness, right? If we're multicultural, we're not racist, but we can be very anti-black. They wouldn't say that, but it's just I kind of like got lost in the two. I think a lot of places are anti-black, and especially white liberalism is a place we can find it. It's the world. The same thing with black women. That conversation we had earlier of black women being blasted for no reason out of the blue. People just walking around talking negatively about black women. It's not paranoia. It's just I find that happen.
Thank you, because it does feel like paranoia sometimes.
But look, you don't even need to do this.
Right.
But other people just listen to a conversation and wonder why a black woman got thrown under the bus for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like out of the blue. But the same thing with black people. And as someone who's been in this, I've been in Northern Nevada now 13 years full time. I came here 20 years ago. I understand now what it is to try to do something for black people in Northern Nevada. And how much trouble people are going to cause hell for you.
Yes.
No matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So putting those two together, people don't understand intersectionality and there exists a lot of anti-blackness. Then you could say a lot of things that you're trying to do, but talk is cheap.
Like, right.
Do things that are not anti-black and I'll know that it's not anti-black.
Right.
And if that's in terms of the university, I think the university is getting, and first of all, I am the university.
Right, yeah.
And other black faculty are the university. We just, in some cases, don't feel like we represent the university. So recently we started a black faculty group and we spend a lot of time talking about it.
Nice.
Yeah, but it's new. I'd like, you got to ask why a university that was founded in 1874 doesn't have any kind of organization for black faculty and how much work it has taken. The party that was intended for the intersectional, that's a person, it's a conversation. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a reality on our campus. You know, they help with that. So I guess where I'm at with anything black at this time is just like, you got to trust people until they prove you. I'm leery, of course, but I can't be as paranoid as
right. Well, not paranoid, but at the same time, it does feel like I even sometimes feel like I'm not allowed to talk about just being black anymore. Like sometimes I'm like, yeah, because black women and indigenous women and Latinx people and trans, like I can never just be like, as a like black women, this, I have to reel it back and include and think about the circle of the other people that I need to include in the conversation. Which is maybe like an overthinking thing, but at some point, it's like I'm erasing myself even in these conversations without realizing, because I'm so worried about offending these other sisters that I don't want, you know, I don't want to leave unincluded, but I do feel like there are issues specific to black women that can just be that.
And to be honest, there are issues with the other communities as well that are specific to their communities. So why can't we focus on our issues?
Right.
And Tiffany Young says this quite a bit, and she's the director of equity and diversity at the school district. But she says, you know, if we are so few, why can't we just resolve some of these problems, right?
Right.
So if we were able to focus on the things that we know and can identify as black issues in our community, why can't we work on them? And yet, exactly what you said, the critique offered by that faculty member, it shuts things down before they get even started.
Because I don't feel like anything is less racist now. We've had a whole summer of discontent. I feel like we've had a lot of talks. Good job, everybody. We talked. Yet
Where's the change?
You know, yeah, like saying like the end. Now when I watch the NBA with the dude, I see the words Black Lives Matter. Cool story, bro.
Cool story. Like, but that comes from someone, from you, who understands.
Yeah.
That, and I hear this a lot. So I've been in community all summer. This is the most pro-Black, meaning I work with Black people as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
because we understand, like, we're Black all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We're not Black when that Black Lives Matter is turned down, turned off, erased, flipped sideways, or forgotten
right.
all day long, or you when you didn't happen to walk past it. It's going to be at night when I'm alone with my thoughts. The things that you said in that little moment, I'm talking not about you, but other people who are hateful, mm-hmm. they come back. That Black is there. It's present. And so, of course, we want change because the little flashing sign didn't really change much.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you got to be appreciative for it because you didn't see it before.
Right.
But
it's like, well,
I'm still
you know,
Black.
Yeah, exactly. And being appreciative for it is also such a, I just feel like it's like kissing the ring of white supremacy. Like, oh, thank you so much for saying that our lives matter on the basketball game. Now can Breonna Taylor's killers please be in jail?
Well, that's my answer to the PWI.
Yeah.
And at some point, I read this somewhere. I don't know where I read it. But that a red carpet had to be put down for white people in Black space.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, they're going to feel uncomfortable. And at a PWI, I think that's a tenet. My dissertation, I interviewed black professors who teach hip-hop at predominantly white institutions around the country. And some similar stuff was coming out. But that one's the one where, you know what? For me to love who I am doesn't mean I have to hate you.
Mm-hmm.
Even though our... And that's like a tagline on social media, but in how it plays out is, you know what? If I come into Black space because I love Black people and we talk and we get loud and we do whatever we do that you are offended by, it doesn't mean I hate you. It means I love my people.
Mm-hmm.
And I start to talk different, react different when I'm around Black people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with hating you.
Right.
It's a happy thing.
Right.
Yeah, the reason why I asked the PWI question was, and I'm sure you know this person, shout out to Anijah Boyd. She wrote a piece called Black Girls at PWIs. And do you remember Anijah from a few years ago? Yeah. And she wrote something that says that she talks about her first interactions meeting like other Black women and Black people at the campus and how like excited she was and how one of her good friends, they talked about where we were going to find the rest of the Black people on campus. So that was like where the question came from. That was the inspiration. So shout out to Anijah Boyd. Check out her Medium.
Nice.
What's up, Nyjah? Nyjah's my student. Of course, right? And two taught me a million things. So we did what Black Girls at PWIs. That's her Twitter. And she's now moved on to a great career, and she does social media for a major group of casinos in Vegas. But she first of all promoted a lot of things on campus. Did a lot of work. She's actually a hip-hop scholar.
Mm-hmm.
She knows hip-hop in and out, taught me a ton about hip-hop, and knows about women in hip-hop. But she battled, and her friends battled, all of my people, coming here from Vegas and other places, and it being predominantly white. And I don't think people understand what predominantly white means
yeah.
to someone when you come from another place, and you're just like, how did it get so white?
So white. It got so, yeah, it's what it is too, is like those little things. Like when you sit in a restaurant, white people or non-Black people, I want you to remember the last time you sat in a restaurant as the only person of your race. Because for me, it's every single time I've been in a restaurant ever here, ever. And for y'all, it's never. That never happened. Like I couldn't find a place to bring someone where that is white. That they would be the only white person, at least, like, to eat or something like that. And when Nathaniel was here, we talked about that a lot. He was like, is this – it's always like this. Like, oh, yes. It's always like this. You're always the only one, and we know you're looking at us also.
Yeah. And yeah, Nathaniel talked about too, he's also from Vegas, about like there's not a lot of like queer community here either that he couldn't find. But I mean, like, I think UNR, and we've talked about this on the show a lot too, is like it's so specific and unique in the sense that like there are like swastikas like, you know, put around campus, and like how like that's scary for someone who is Black or Latinx, Asian, indigenous.
Jewish. But,
yes, Jewish. Yeah, of course. Yeah. But then also, Peter C. being involved with UNR. We were talking about earlier the campus police officer that dressed up as a like caricature, basically, of Colin Kaepernick. Or like the fact that the Nevada Wolfpack is barely recognizing Colin Kaepernick now for the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like the campus is just so white. The Mackey statue. We can go on and on about how like a white supremacy is just like riddled through UNR. How like I know there's a campaign a couple years ago. I don't know if Nyjah was involved with that, but trying to get a building named after the first Black woman that graduated from UNR. So I think sometimes to me, it feels like UNR just kind of slaps like, oh, here's a rainbow Nevada symbol. Like, you know.
Yeah, they
like,
Democratic Party it for sure.
Yeah, but they don't actually, yeah, like we were talking about earlier, don't really care. It's just like, you know, I don't know what you just said.
Or how hard it is for them to denounce things to me is like, Peter Sajanovic is not, look, here I am trying to pronounce your name, you stupid Nazi. don't even care. I like that you say C. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Not studying it. But it wasn't as much his existence at that rally. It was how hard it was to get rid of him. That should not have been hard. Mm-hmm. And I feel like had it happened yesterday, it would have been like, he is gone, canceled, everything is revoked. But a couple of years ago, boy, was it hard to get him out.
I don't know if it would be different today.
You don't think so?
Having experienced it and lived it and going back a little bit about the university, like that's the thing though. We are there. Black people are there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this summer, you know, white people recognize that we're there. We've been graduating Black people for a while from this institution, and successfully. I guess it's going to be a function of segregation, integration, that we're going to be there. And it was even said recently, hyper visible and yet not seen.
Mm.
And so we are there. We do have a presence. We are connected with Vegas, other Black communities that are close by, where families come on campus. And yet we still get this kind of Cap is my student. And all, you know, I'm not telling Cap student stories because I haven't talked to him for a while. But the man sat in my office quite a bit and yet goes to the Bay Area and gets a Black awareness. He came from here.
Right.
So what I might have to say is one of, and I'm going to give him this prop, is one of the leaders of our time, this generation, came right out of that seat.
Mm-hmm.
And so did Peter C. What the hell is it about?
Yeah.
What's going on
What's
up here?
What's happening at this
that
university?
That produces all these people.
Yeah. It's a very wide range of students is what the first thing they could say. Here at UNR, we have a very wide range of students.
Ain't nobody
from
saying
Nazis
that.
To Colin
Ain't nobody
Kaepernick.
Saying that.
No.
But so that to me says, it says, you know what? And I don't know why I keep saying it. Because I think in all honesty, it would happen again.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And it could,
the thing to me is if you look at history where protests happen on college campuses, it does get worse.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't just become a battle of this and that, that people do actually make moves.
Mm-hmm.
We take our group of students to San Francisco State, which is the first Black Studies program, and they do have a history of protests that is violent,
mm-hmm.
and to protect Black Studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so and of strikes. And so we're here like, oh, we're going to talk about free. You know, we talked about freedom of speech so much after that. But we still just talking. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like what is going to change is when something has to change.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just tell people that freedom of speech exists and that you can protect hate speech.
Right. Right.
And just blur it out because of the law.
Which it was.
Yes, which it totally was. It was.
But wait, the students on campus did not let that happen.
Yeah.
Y'all friends,
that's
y'all
true.
Students were taking over the airwaves.
That's true.
I was in the KC. I just got a call this one day. I was in the KC. I'm standing there just...
The Flyers you're talking about.
The Flyers come flying out of the sky! The Flyers!
So that's what I was going to bring up. Yeah, when... Because there was a couple years ago with, like, Nevada Student Power and Anija and a bunch of group of students in kind of a... I don't know, a conflict or what was it? Like, a back to Peter C., giving his thesis, there was a protest for that, like trying to like disrupt mm-hmm. his thesis, like, no, you can't have this, you can't graduate. Then there was like, yeah, the library where we dropped several flyers and then dropped a couple banners in the...
Several, there's like... How many flyers? That's like 2,000 pieces of paper. I did not know what was going on. And I'm like, where did that come? That's all students. And so what I'm getting at with that is the narrative in this town will always be Peter C. Mm-hmm. But the people who were there know how many times did students put up signs. I mean, they wore facilities out. They mm-hmm. wore campus police out. UNR is racist. UNR protects racists. That's something most people will probably not ever remember. That's something history will not tell about the campus in that moment. But students were extremely active.
Yes.
And they weren't letting people take over the narrative. And that, to me, is the beauty, I think, maybe, because they try to shut down students, the administration, but the students would, I think maybe that's the beauty of Nevada for me, of students who stood up and said, you know what, this is not going, this history is going to be told a different way. Because at the time, it was, the Black Lives Matter banner went down, and then...
It was a DACA banner.
A DACA banner, right? Mm-hmm. And students protest. Actually, most of my protests in this town has been for immigration reform. Mm-hmm. It hasn't necessarily been black. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the tense times have come from this town being racist against immigrants.
Yeah, totally.
And so, and that's where I think it's a different flip for your question, mm-hmm. is that, yes, we do need to work together here.
Mm-hmm.
Intersectionality, okay, as a theory. Do people who are being oppressed in this town need to come together? Yes. In instances that we have, we actually had some strength.
Have. Yeah.
So it's not this whitewash or wash out rainbow coalition. It's like, yo, we still don't have an answer for a lot of questions about the police, and a lot of communities still don't have those answers.
Right.
So I very much support understanding what anti-blackness is, but I also work with a lot of people mm-hmm. because oppression is intersecting. These yes. things they do for other communities, they're going to do for us, and they're just going to keep people in fear, mm-hmm. and no one's in fear. And as we talk that story in public, then we're going to get our fear out, and we're going to work together. I work with a lot of people in this town, mm-hmm. a lot of people, a lot of different ways. And that's one thing I think is so strange. They call Reno the biggest little city, but there are actually a lot of communities here.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come together, this is a great place.
Yeah, that's the thing too. I do. I enjoy the little communities in Reno, and I do feel like that's why I want to go so hard for Reno and changing it, because it feels so possible. Because
so
there
tangible.
Are, yeah, it's so tangible. Because there are so many great people doing so many great things mm-hmm. that it's like you cannot throw a stick without finding someone helping someone else. Where in these larger cities, it's not as tangible. You know, it's much more spread out. And I do like that about Reno. So I want to lean in on it. You know, even if it's not where I was born, mm-hmm. it's where I am home now. You know,
yeah, definitely. Like I know, like I mean, Vegas is doing their thing with mass liberation. Like bigger cities can do that, but just like everyone knows each other in Reno. And I think we could really take advantage of that, like you said, it's biggest little city. It's the small aspect of Reno where everyone is in community with each other. I think it's just going to take, and I've said this before, the non-glamorous work of, like, reaching out to folks, finding, like, those neighborhoods and, like, knocking doors, like, you know, starting up, like, the Rainbow Coalition, like, Black Panther programs, like, mutual aid programs and breakfast programs, like, ask people what they need. I think there's like I think there could be something for that here, especially with the homelessness population, mm-hmm. houselessness population that we have here.
Speaking of that, we were in a little tiff. I think I've gotten in a tiff. I had a busy weekend or busy week online, but about the CARES funds. There was in a meeting that I did not hallucinate where they said that they had $9 million of the $45 million of CARES funds they were going to use for the houseless community for a super duper shelter or whatever they want to call it. And it's cold and the super duper shelter has not been built. And that's kind of, you know, it's very, to me, it's very simple. But it seems like every time I call out an official on something like that, it becomes this very, whoa, little girl, let's sit down. This is much more difficult than you could possibly imagine. And it just doesn't feel like it's that hard to build homes for people or put them in homes that already exist. So I've asked a couple of people on the show this. I know it's kind of just like deterring from what we were talking about, but if you had $9 million for houselessness right now, what is the first thing you would do and would it be done already?
The would it be done already? I'm going to take a shot at myself and I know, you, but I'm just telling you from my experience, as I've had a million ideas this summer to fix things that I'm doing an audit of myself this mm-hmm. week. I'm like, this is not working. This is not working. This is not working. And at some point, and I don't think it's about me. I think it's about when you tackle certain problems,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason why we have homeless people in this town.
Yes.
So, and I don't think there are a reason why we don't have things for Black students.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think those things are accidental. I think those things are very intentional. And I'm feeling a little bit maybe frustrated. So, but if I had the $9 million, let's do something. You know what I mean? My grandmother was Salvation Army, and she had things there. But she spent her life feeding people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that a lot of people understand the urgency of not having food.
Right. Or it's a problem today, now, yes.
And we're not going to talk about it in a meeting for 10 hours that we don't do nothing about month after month. Someone's still hungry, right?
Yeah.
So I might even just take away and I might even do my best to take away the instant urgency of needing basic needs, human needs. And I think on campus, I feel this a lot lately, that people talk about class and they talk about different social needs, but they never been homeless. They never been hungry. Right. I need to wash my clothes. I need to take a shower. I need to brush my teeth.
Right.
Do I have a place?
Right.
And so, you know, Courtney Bell, Soap for Hope, I know he did a lot for a while. Mm-hmm. I haven't caught up with them recently, but I mean, those things that actually meet people's needs, and it may not be sustainable, but let's feed people.
Right. Exactly. And it's so easy. Oh my gosh. It's so easy for us. Like, I didn't have that much time this weekend and I still wanted to make my commitment to Burrito Project. And it took almost nothing out of my day to make 10 pounds of rice and 4 pounds of beans. It took nothing. There was nothing I couldn't do that I was still moving, still doing all these other things. And, it, you know, for under $20, you know, I got like a couple of blankets are on sale right now and hand warmers at Walmart and stuff like that. You know, like it took nothing and it was nothing to me. And I'm not somebody who makes a lot of money to just like make some food, just do something. So again, as always, shout out Burrito Project. We love you guys. But, you know, all of those things, the Grant Denton is doing some great stuff. And there's another, I'm trying to remember what they're called, just Citizens of the Universe. Do you know what it's called? Anyway, there's a bunch of people doing stuff, and there's no reason why anybody listening can't be that person. You know, you can always be the person doing something, and I think that's what my particular frustration is that I feel like whenever there are these huge chunks of money and funds being talked about, it's always, well, there are these stipulations, and there's this, and there's that, and I'm like, okay, well, you personally couldn't do anything, or no one can do anything. This is the best we can do. Because it seems like when it comes to sweeps and throwing everybody's stuff away, that can happen immediately all the time. That's always something that's can immediately be taken care of. But feeding people, housing them, is this like we need 300 meetings to, you know, where nothing really ends up happening.
I think maybe shout out to Evelyn Mount. It sounds like a very black woman thing to say. And I'm in a serious, like,
it's true.
Evelyn Mount, I was sitting with her one day and she's like, you know what? We saw things that needed to be done at HUG and we went over there and we did them. And yeah. we started this group and we started feeding people on Thanksgiving and just, and was she wealthy either? No, she just did things. And I think maybe what we're getting to is when you put money around things, that there's so much room for mismanagement
mm-hmm.
and that people are going to use it for their own gain, even when it's directly supposed to be for something that would benefit a group of people.
Right.
But if you don't have the power to fight for that, then the money part of it is where it's going to get all mixed up. But like you just said, I just cooked. I did this for a burrito project, right? Like, yep. I just did it.
Sorry, it was just done. Do it. Yeah, it's like there's a Wonder Woman meme where she's laying down and she says, no, I'll do it. I'll do it. And that it does feel like that is a very, very black woman / woman thing to do. It's just like, no, F it. I'll do it. Never mind. Like, I'm not going to argue with you anymore. Council member, I'm just going to make this rice and beans. Like, I'm done. Which is what I ended up doing that day instead of continuing the argument because there was no point.
The sister organization that works for the Reno Burrito Project is United Federation of the Universe.
Thank
you. And
they
make the hygiene kits.
Yeah. Well, everybody can make hygiene kits. Yeah, exactly. And they do. Yeah, they do that. And then also Food Not Bombs is the other one I was thinking about. So good job, all of y'all. And those are also groups of other proletariat people, you know, these are just regular people with holes in their shoes like all of us, you know. I would love to see some people of more stable economic backgrounds helping because I'm not seeing that. They talk about it, but I just have yet to see any of them be about it. Right.
So we're not solving houselessness today.
We're not solving houselessness.
There's another pandemic going on out there. Like,
yeah.
What are we gonna do about it?
Yeah.
It's wild. In these 2020 did us.
Did you see that Saturday? There was a Saturday Night Live sketch where there was the fortune teller about 2020, and they're all in 2019. Like, yeah, 2020 is the year. And it's just so, like, you start laughing before they even come with the jokes because it's just like, that was so all of us. I don't even remember what 2019 did to me that I felt so disenfranchised by it, but certainly nothing.
Trump.
Yeah, oh, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was all the years, yeah.
It was still, like, a culmination.
So did you vote?
Not yet. I will vote. I have my ballot. I have places on campus we can vote pretty easily.
Yeah. Well, what we like to talk about on the show is how that is just a very tiny thing, but not at all it, right? That's not at all it. So we want everyone to be very motivated the day after the election, regardless of the results, because none of you get to stay in bed and cry this time.
I want to stay in bed and cry.
No.
You don't. I already know. I know.
We all, just by the way, we all know already. It's only like white neoliberals that are like, but maybe. No, guys. No. I don't think so.
I'm raising my eyebrows. That's all you can see on the radio.
Yeah.
But it's only because last time I sat in my office till like 3 and cried. I was on campus like,
yeah.
Is this real? Like, this is real.
Mm-hmm.
And
this
so
is real.
We have another election day.
So if for some reason the results aren't legit, which I don't know, as somebody who's experienced racism a lot, I feel like they'll be pretty legit. But if they're not, I think that we could take a nod from some knowledge from Bolivia and do a general strike. I think we're due for a general strike.
I might move to Bolivia.
Right.
And I think that their answer is you should go. We don't want you. I think that's what they say if you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, please. I'll start a GoFundMe for anyone who would like me to go back to whatever country you decided that I'm from. Because I don't know, but you might. So we would all love to go back to those countries now. I'm sure everyone that people are like, go back to the wherever we want to. Please send us there.
This is me being semi-political diplomatically, but I just don't think – I think a lot of Americans, I'm going to use that term broadly, think that it's the American dream. No one understands that people are living the American nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're part of the American dream, then you're like, why – is anyone else, why are you even saying what you're saying? Like, this is a beautiful thing. or they didn't live a day in someone living the American nightmare. And so if you're living, even some things that appear to be the American dream can be the American nightmare flipped on just an experience that you have. And it's like, yo, I'm tired of the nightmare.
Right. I mean, how many paychecks or whatever checks are we away from, you know, really being houseless ourselves or food insecure or anything? And I think that's why those people are helping, because they realize how close they are to it. It's the people that are tucked safely in their beds that are like, oh, this is fine.
I want to be tucked safely in my bed.
I want that too. Yeah. And that's the thing that I've noticed too in like a lot of activist circles, where there are some, you know, white folks that seem like it's like fun for them to go and protest. Like they're making it a hangout all the time. It's like, you know, they're having all this fun, where I'm like, I bet every single black person would like to just go to the beach. Like, we don't want to do this. It's not funsies all the time. Like, we just want to take a nap. I just want to sleep without waking up and be like, oh, you know, thrown into whatever and this like constant exhaustion. So I think, you know, those folks that are just having so much fun protesting, I'm even, you know, they've even colonized protesting at this point. How did you do that? How do you do that?
White supremacy.
It's, yeah. It's a powerful beast. I was this whole time I've been thinking about what song could we possibly play?
Let's play Jody's song.
That would reflect this conversation. So is there a song that you'd like to play?
I'm trying to think of one now after we had a black feminism talk.
That's what I was thinking.
Are we going to think out loud? Let's think out loud.
Yeah, think out loud. I mean, I was almost thinking about playing that No Name song.
Play the No Name song. The No Name. It's got to be the No Name.
It's got to. It's got to be. All right.
I mean.
The one that the J. Cole diss.
It's not a diss. No. Well, not. No, the one that she. Her
in
retort.
Response, yeah.
Her retort.
Rebuttal.
It is. It's got to be a top hit on mine. And then is there anything you wanted to, I'm kind of stalling. Is there anything you want to talk about before we get off here?
Is this going to be the last song we play?
I think so.
Okay. I thought we were going to play more than two songs.
I know, but then now look at us though. We're so far.
I have a song if you want to do three. I don't know if we have time though.
I just want to say thank you for having me and the work that you do. I mostly listened to the first few episodes of your show, and now I'll have to get back. But really powerful, and it's a void for it. And so, as soon as you messaged me, I was like, yes, please. I'll be there. And
I'd love to have you back. I'm a fan of you now.
Here's the secret. I have my own show. It's called Hip Hop Studies.
Oh, perfect.
And we can do this as much as you want. Hell yes.
I'll like it. The crossover episode.
Shout out to K-Wink.
Shout out, K-Wink. Thank you for amplifying all of our voices.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, so you just said you listened to a first few of our shows, what your take on the Micaiah Lee situation was. Because we organized heavily with that under mass liberation. We're kind of just getting it started in the North. But we had a die-in protest. And we laid down in front of the street. I believe Sierra Street, in front of District Attorney Chris Hicks. I'm not sure if you follow that office. And even
we don't
though
like him.
We were talking about earlier how protests aren't always powerful. All my years being here and organizing, I think was the most powerful thing, because a few days later after that, District Attorney Christopher Hicks released the body cam footage and the police report that hadn't been released for months. And previous officer-involved shootings, it has taken over two years.
We're getting right back to, we're in 2018, if anyone is keeping track. Mm-hmm. They went right back to processing the 2018 body cam and police reports that are happening, which is absolutely unacceptable. It doesn't take 2 years to do anything.
Yeah, I agree. So I was just wondering what your take on that was, and what you thought about that.
First, there's so much going through my head, mostly that this happened here at a time when around the country we were focusing so much on it, and it was right here. Mm-hmm. From talking to the mother, like, and the idea, she told them, right? She mm-hmm. warned them, I need you to respond this way because this is what might happen.
It was the most well-communicated 911 call I've ever heard. I've never heard someone with so together and clear about the issue that they were walking into.
So maybe in the vein of, say, his name, in my work, I most definitely believe we put way too much emphasis on police and not on the victims. Mm-hmm. And the victims will tell you what really needs to change because they're experiencing it and they're experiencing the loss. And not that we're going to make victims re-experience the loss, but they tend to tell, this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. When we get this whole, well, Blue Lives Matter, like, forget this. A person lost their life.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be restored. And so locally that happened. I've been saying for years that these are the two things that law enforcement needs to do here. This interagency agreement is bad for communities of color. Yeah. And we keep pushing mm-hmm. it as the most happy and friendly thing. And maybe for some people it is, but for us it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And second, that agencies investigate each other. So if a Sparks officer shoots someone, then it could be a Reno sheriff. Someone, another agency is going to investigate. That's bad for me. And it was in my head earlier this week. I was like, 5 months. Like, we didn't get it. I read another report for a Latino man who was shot in Sparks. Yeah, and the Ronaldo, thing, you couldn't
Bruce
even
Wood.
Read it.
No,
it was like,
like
202, like pages and pages of mm-hmm. issue. Mm-hmm. And so, but what really did come back to me is that 5 month thing and that your protest sparked that report coming out when it wouldn't have had to come out. No one would have asked. No one would have cared that this young man was dead on our watch. Yeah. Murdered.
And does that mean we have to do that every time? Because now there's 25, I believe, other people. So we have to lay in the road in front of your office, district attorney, 25 more times? Or can you do your job?
Imagine if you didn't do it, though.
Right.
You know, at this point, all I'm saying is y'all, much love.
Thank you.
And I think...
Shout out to Susan. We love you, Susan.
We love you, Susan. And I think, we got some critique for that, I think, too, that protests on the BLM page because people were saying, you know, we need to do... And I agree when we were talking about it earlier on the show, how, like, protesting gets co-opted and there's, like, kind of, like, this white supremacist sort of thing or, like, it's, like, fun for white people. But we got critique from a white person saying that we need to do more than hold up a sign that says racism is bad, and I kind of clapped back and said, you know, we
did.
Were risking arrest.
We did.
Yeah, I'm like, we risked arrest that day. You know, I was scared. Like, you know, like, I was down to get arrested, but it's just like, you know, like.
That would have been the best. I mean, I was, you know, I'm always worried about A, getting shot, B, getting arrested.
Yeah.
I'm more always worried about getting arrested because I'm always leaving my kid in these situations where my kid really likes to go out and use his rights and exercise his rights. But as the climate gets more and more the way it is, I'm leaving him at home more and more because I just don't feel like he's safe all the time, you know, which is sad because he likes to stand out on the corner and yell, too. But, you know, he's just as disgruntled and is very aware that he's going to be a black man soon. And if in the law enforcement's eyes, maybe already is, even though he's 11, which makes me very scared all the time.
Tamir Rice.
Like, yeah, like Tamir. Exactly. That was when he turned 11. That was the first thought I had. And I was like, I hate it here. I can't believe that's the first thing. I should have thought so many other things. And the first thing I thought was Tamir Rice. So, yeah.
I've been pulling out from Soul on Fire, Eldridge Cleaver. He has a list of it's right around 20 black men killed by the CIA from 1968 to 1969, you know, starting with Bobby Hutton. Ending with Bobby Hutton, I think. Targeted. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Not even – and their ages are so young. They're going to make the movie about Fred Hampton.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about that.
But this is facts. This is history and not in a sense of learning but in a sense of, yes, you should expect this government is coming for you. Mm-hmm. That government agents, state police, state agent police, state actors are going to be able to shoot you without any kind of – I mean, shot in your sleep? That's right. The one we can't – how can we reconcile that?
Well, and the fact that people want to just, they want to debate about it. What is the debate? Why is there a debate? How, and it's also those people that aren't law enforcement that debate, they act like it can't happen to them. Like, that'll happen to you, too. If you're not wearing mm-hmm. the suit, you're not in the club. It doesn't matter how many times you defend them on the internet or on, you know, at a protest. They don't care about you either. Mm-hmm. It's a club. You're not in it.
Yeah. Yeah, just so sad. I think, like, yeah, that's kind of – Susan really opened my eyes and I think both of our eyes to the fact that there's this community here of people who otherwise wouldn't come together, who are now in a Facebook group together of – they've lost loved ones from either Reno Sparks Police Department or Washoe County Sheriff's Department.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it's just like it can happen to anyone. It can happen to you. And people are mean online and say really messed up things about Micaiah Lee that should not be said and just like straight up lies and they just don't care. And it's really sad.
I know you already said this too, but Lily, you said it early, like at this point, I'm not really interested in the people that don't understand it yet.
Mm-hmm.
The people who understand what it's like to live without and to be honest, that's why this is a conversation I've had for so long, is because this is how we've grown up expecting this, right? This isn't new. This isn't something now it's getting some shine. But I want to talk to the people who understand what it's like to have a family member incarcerated, who lost someone from their family because of police brutality or in a lot of ways, right?
Right.
And if I can't convince you, look, it's not really my energy. My energy is if you understand, what can we do for our people?
Yeah. We have to just keep it moving, everybody. Like, I've been trying to advise some of my white friends are still doing the thing where they're arguing with their family members. Just let it go. Just mm-hmm. eat Thanksgiving and keep it moving. Like, you don't need to. If we spend all of our time trying to convince people that your existence is important, we're no longer protecting mm-hmm. our existence and you need to take care of yourself. And I feel like that's self-harm, you know, at mm-hmm. a certain point, it's totally. Self-harm. Just don't mess with them anymore.
Yeah, and that's something I really had to learn. And I, like, recently have been saying I want to get rid of social media just because I think sometimes it's toxic because I just, like you're saying, you, like, certain subjects, you kind of get, you rant and you get, like, triggered and angry. And that's just, like, that coming out. And I just, like, have to respond because mm-hmm. it's just, like, I'm so angry.
I've been having this opposite feeling now. I mean, I think that social media in some way, I guess it's definitely toxic, but I find that in a social circles, sometimes you aren't really listened to when you want to talk about Shiva. And then on social media, like, you have to listen sometimes. So I feel like sometimes people that wouldn't otherwise listen do now, you know, once you're on a social media platform. So I think there are pros and cons there.
The reason I closed my socials may have been in part that, but one of the biggest reasons is that I felt like it was a popular place to promote Black death.
Mm.
And so many images.
Yeah,
it was Kobe.
It was, yeah, that was hurting.
I had to turn it off. I was like, I can't see a Black man die, his daughter. This is not, I'm not doing good with this.
Yeah.
And so that's what it was for me, but there are definitely other reasons.
Yeah. Yes, please don't share those. Don't share those videos. We don't need to see those. All right. Well, we have had an amazing conversation. I can't wait to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. All right. Well, we're Mass Liberation Radio, 97.7. Thanks for listening today.
I'm Kaylee.
And I'm Lily. And this is No Name, song 33.